Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, the New Testament, the Acts of the Apostles, Epistles, and the Book of Revelation. Our guest, as usual, and the author of this series is Ron Eldred, who teaches at John Paul II Catholic High. And I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, chaplain at the Carmelite Monastery at the entrance of Allendale, and chaplain for John Paul II Catholic High at 12 Points in Terre Haute. Ron, we left off with St. Paul having to defend himself before the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem because of all the commotion and crowd stirring up that he's supposedly causing. And we need to hear a little bit about Paul's own defense before the Jewish Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin.
When Paul first addressed the Sanhedrin by saying that he had lived before God in all good conscience up to this day, and Ananias, the high priest at the time, ordered those closest to Paul to strike him on the mouth for his boldness. Josephus tells us in his Antiquities that Ananias officiated as high priest from about 47 to 59 AD, that he was accused of being responsible for acts of violence by Quadratus, the Roman governor of Syria, and sent to Rome for trial in 52 AD. He was acquitted by the emperor Claudius. Because of his friendship with the Romans, he was killed by the people at the beginning of the first Jewish-Roman war in 66 AD. Paul responded to his blows by calling Ananias a whitewashed wall, but apologized when he discovered that he was the high priest. Apparently he didn't know he was the high priest. When Paul noticed that the council consisted of Sadducees and Pharisees, he tried to play one off against the other. He appealed to the Pharisees by saying that he was a Pharisee himself, and like them, believed in the resurrection of the dead, angels and spirits, whereas the Sadducees didn't believe in any of these. Paul's strategy worked because the two groups got into a violent argument over these issues. The Pharisees wanted to free Paul, but the Sadducees didn't. The Sadducees were primarily the chief priest and, of course, the high priest. The argument got so heated that the tribune was afraid that Paul would get hurt, so he sent his soldiers into the council chamber to bring him back into the safety of the barracks. The Lord assured him that night that just as he had testified before him in Jerusalem, he was to do so in Rome as well.
Okay, now didn't some of the Jews plot at this time to actually kill Paul?
Yes, they did. More than 40 of them took an oath to eat nothing until he had killed him. They and the Sanhedrin conspired to get the tribune to allow Paul to be brought back to the council for a peaceful resolution to the problem. They planned to assassinate him on the way to the council chamber. Fortunately, Paul's sister, and we find out in his letters there that he had a sister that lived in Jerusalem, Paul's sister's son heard about the plot and informed Paul, who in turn had the centurion take the boy to tell the tribune of the attempt to be made on Paul's life. The tribune ordered two of his centurions to assemble close to 500 soldiers to accompany Paul safely to the governor. His name was Felix in Caesarea. That was the capital where the Romans ruled Judea. The tribune sent a letter to the governor explaining in detail the problem and ordered his accusers to go to the governor and explain what they had against Paul. When the contingent of soldiers reached Caesarea, the centurion presented Paul to Felix along with the letter. When the governor learned that Paul was from Cilicia, he agreed to consider the case when the accusers arrived. Meanwhile, Paul was kept in Herod's Praetorium, or fortress, for safekeeping, and this story is told in Acts 23.
Okay, so Paul is accused before Felix, the governor. Can you tell us something about that rather dramatic event?
Antonius Felix was a freedman of the imperial family who was appointed procurator of Judea by the Emperor Nero in 52 AD. He had a reputation for cruelty and licentiousness, as well as for taking bribes. St. Luke tells us this in Acts 24. The period of his rule was marked by a great increase of crime in Judea, internal feuds and disturbances, which he put down with great severity.
Okay, will you say something specific about Paul's trial before the governor Felix?
Well, 5 days after Paul had arrived there, the high priest Ananias and some elders and a spokesman named Tertullus came from Jerusalem to accuse Paul before the governor. After trying to flatter Felix by telling him how wonderful a reformer he was, Tertullus accused Paul of being an agitator and a ringleader of a sect called the Nazarenes, that he had profaned their temple. So they arrested him. By profaned, I think they probably meant they thought he had brought a pagan, you know, a non-Jew into their temple. The other Jews concurred with the accusation. Felix told Paul to answer their charges. In his defense, he said that he had done nothing to stir up the crowd in the temple. The synagogues are in the city. However, he did admit that he was a member of the sect called the Way, who worshipped the God of their fathers, believing what had been laid down by the law or written in the prophets, and having a hope in God, which even his accusers accepted, and believing that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. You might recall that the early Christians called themselves the Way.
The Way.
It wasn't until a little later, in the first century, that they began to call themselves Christians in Antioch.
And then, of course, Antioch.
And that spread out, you know, throughout the whole world eventually. He told Felix that he had simply come to the temple to undergo purification and to offer alms, not to stir up a crowd, but that some Asiatic Jews had accused him of being a troublemaker. Paul said that they should be here to make the accusations themselves, that is, these Asiatic Jews, and not just simply the Jews from the city of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. He told Felix that the reason he was before him was because of his belief in the resurrection of the dead.
Okay. So what was Felix's decision about all this?
Although Felix was a Roman, he knew quite a bit about the Jewish religion. But partly it was because he was married to a Jewish woman named Drusilla, who was a daughter of King Herod Agrippa I. He told Paul that he would decide his case when Lysias, the tribune, came to Caesarea. But in the meantime, he was to be kept in custody with some freedom to see his friends. After a few days, Felix summoned Paul to explain his views to him and his wife. However, the governor became alarmed when Paul spoke about future judgment regarding justice and self-control and ordered him to leave them. In other words, Felix was known for being sexually promiscuous and a number of other things, and apparently that bothered him. He summoned Paul many times during the next 2 years, perhaps hoping that at least in part, that Paul would give him a bribe, because he was known for that too, accepting bribes. When Felix's term was over, he left Paul in prison in favor of the Jews. When he returned to Rome, he was accused of using a dispute between the Jews and Syrians of Caesarea as a pretext to slay and plunder the inhabitants. But through the intercession of his brother, Paulus, who had great influence with the Emperor Nero, he escaped punishment. And he was succeeded by Porcius Festus. And that story goes on in Acts 24.
Okay, Paul defends himself now before the governor Festus and uses his right and appeals to Caesar. What can you tell us about that?
Porcius Festus was procurator of Judea for a very short time. between 58 and 62 A.D. sometime. They're not exactly sure. Probably, most likely, 60 A.D. During his administration, Jewish hostility to Rome greatly increased because of the civic privileges issued to certain influential Jews. The hard feelings that were aroused contributed to the revolt in 66 A.D. It led to the first Jewish war, which, of course, in the year 70, ended in the Romans destroying the temple and the city and carrying off most of the Jewish people into captivity, the ones they hadn't killed. As we will see, Paul had his final hearing before Festus, probably in 60 A.D.
Okay, how did the trial go before the governor Festus?
One of the first activities that Festus did during his short administration was go up to Jerusalem to consult with the Jewish leadership. They told him about Paul and asked that he be sent to them for trial. Of course, their intention was to ambush and kill him along the way. Those guys that had taken the oath that they were going to kill him, you know, they weren't going to eat until they kill him, the 40 guys. They must be getting pretty hungry by now. But instead, Festus told the Jews to come with him to Caesarea to accuse Paul. I don't know whether or not he had any suspicion of their plan, that is, Festus. Mm-hmm. You have to have a feeling he probably did. When they got to Caesarea, Festus had Paul brought before him and his accusers. After hearing their charges against Paul and his defense, Festus asked him if he wanted to go to Jerusalem for trial. Although there was no truth to their charges against Paul, Festus didn't want to offend the Jewish leadership by having to rule on Paul's favor. In other words, he was trying to get out of it if he possibly could, making any kind of decision. Of course, Paul objected and said that he had ought to be tried before Caesar's impartial tribunal, not before his Jewish accusers. He said that he would be willing to die if he had done anything wrong. But the charges against him were false. Therefore, the procurator had no right to turn him over to the Jews for trial. Then, being a Roman citizen, Paul appealed to Caesar for a resolution to the charges against him. And, of course, that was a right that all Roman citizens had, to appeal, you know, to the Roman imperial courts in Rome. Mm-hmm. Festus gladly conceded to this request because it got him off of the hook, so to speak, off the hook with the Jewish leadership. And that story, of course, is told in Acts 25.
Okay, in the meantime, Paul is presented to King Agrippa and Queen Bernice, who listen attentively to his defense.
Yes, Paul was presented to King Agrippa and Queen Bernice. The king and his wife had come to Caesarea to welcome Festus. Festus, you know, he's a new procurator. He's just come there, and they haven't met him yet, so they came there to welcome him. Festus informed Agrippa about Paul's case, told the king that he found no foundation in the charges brought against Paul by his accusers, that the matter was simply a dispute over their own superstition and about a certain Jesus that Paul claimed rose from the dead. In other words, to Festus, these kind of things probably seem trivial and, you know, and superstitious and all that kind of thing. The procurator told the king that since he didn't know how to decide such matters, he asked Paul whether or not he wanted to go to Jerusalem to settle the matter. But instead, Paul appealed to be kept in custody for the decision of the emperor, to which the procurator agreed. No doubt curious about the matter, Agrippa asked Festus if he could interview the man. The procurator told him that he could do so the next day.
Okay, and very interesting interview. How did that go?
Well, actually, it went pretty well. After the king and queen were brought into the audience hall with great pomp and ceremony, with all the military tribunes and prominent men of the city present, Paul was brought out for the interrogation. Festus told Agrippa that he determined that Paul had done nothing deserving death, but that he had appealed to the emperor for a resolution of the case. The procurator said that he needed help from the king in writing a letter explaining the case to the emperor. In other words, Agrippa, of course, being a Jew himself, was pretty knowledgeable about Jewish matters, so he could, Festus was new to the job, you know, and obviously probably didn't know very much of anything about Jewish customs and the Jewish religion and what have you. The king told Paul to plead his case, which Paul respectfully and methodically outlined for him, reminding the king that being a Jew himself, he would understand the Jewish religion and customs. He explained he was trained as a strict Pharisee and how he persecuted the Christians himself until Jesus appeared to him on the road to Damascus. Then he explained how Jesus had appointed him to go out and preach the gospel to the Gentiles. Then Paul told the king, "Wherefore, O King Agrippa, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision, but declared first to those at Damascus, then at Jerusalem, and throughout the country of Judea, and also to the Gentiles, that they should repent and turn to God and perform deeds worthy of their repentance. For this reason, the Jews seized me in the temple and tried to kill me." Then he closed his defense by saying, "This day I've had the help that comes from God, and so I stand before testifying both to small and great, saying nothing but what the prophets and Moses said would come to pass, that the Christ must suffer, and that by being the first to rise from the dead, he would proclaim light both to the people and to the Gentiles."
So he's really preaching the gospel.
Certainly.
Well, how did Agrippa and Festus react to this closing of Paul's defense?
Festus asserted that his great learning had made him mad, Paul. Paul, in turn, protested that he wasn't mad, but that he was speaking the sober truth. Then Paul tried to appeal to the king's Jewish religiosity by rhetorically asking him if he believed in the prophets, then quickly responding that he knew that he did. He didn't want to insult him, in other words. Agrippa responded sarcastically, "I think that Paul was trying to make him a Christian in too short a time." Paul retorted, "Whether short or long, I would to God that not only you, but also all who hear me this day might become such as I am, except for these chains." End of quote. As the procurator and king were leaving the room after all this discussion, after hearing Paul, his defense, they agreed among themselves that had Paul not appealed to Caesar, that they could free him. But I guess because of the customs, the law, the Roman law, since Paul had appealed to the Roman emperor for a resolution of the case, they couldn't free him and they had to send him to Rome for a trial.
That must have been a pretty strict right of Roman citizens to actually appeal all the way to Rome, whatever their circumstance.
Yes.
So shows Roman law was very intent on justice as much as possible. Well, as Paul's taken prisoner to Rome, he gets into a terrible situation of a shipwreck. Can we discuss a little bit about that journey and the shipwreck?
Yes, this occurred in 60 A.D., and the story is told in Acts 27. Paul's missionary journeys they're essentially over, of course. And according to the New Catholic Encyclopedia, Paul had been arrested in Jerusalem around Pentecost of 58 A.D. and taken to Rome between the fall of 60 A.D. and the spring of 61 A.D. We'll evaluate his missionary work in later sessions of this series, and we'll look at the theology developed in his letters as well. When the time came for him to be sent to Rome, a centurion named Julius was given the task of escorting him during the voyage. A centurion was a Roman soldier. He would be comparable, let's say, to a lieutenant. He was in charge of 100 or 120 men. Ship followed the coastline of Palestine and Phoenicia and Asia Minor, that is Turkey, stopping at ports along the way. In other words, they didn't get too far off the coastline. Most times they could see land. The ship didn't go out too far, which was a custom, of course, back in those days for the most part in sailing. At Sidon.
For safety.
Yeah, for safety, yes. And didn't want to get lost. At Sidon, Phoenicia, Judas allowed Paul to visit with friends of his. Then the ship continued along the coastline of Cilicia and Pamphylia in Asia Minor, the southern coast of what would be Turkey today, until they came to Myra and Lycia. Of course, this is, we said a while ago, or an earlier session, this is where St. Nicholas was to be the bishop there in the 4th century. We know him better, of course, as Santa Claus. From there, they transferred to another ship headed for Italy. Sailing westward along the coast of Asia Minor was very difficult because they were sailing in part against the wind. Eventually, the ship reached Cape Salamone on the northeastern coast of the island of Crete. And with great difficulty, the ship made its way along the southern coast of Crete to the port of Fair Havens, which was near the city of Lycia. The harbor at Fair Havens is formed by a bay open to the east and sheltered on the southwest by two small islands. It's a good place to anchor. The ship was anchored there for a few weeks. Even though it provided a good place to anchor the ship, for it was sheltered from the north and the northwest winds, it was somewhat difficult to obtain provisions for the ship from Lycia, which was several miles away. In other words, the ship was over here anchored one place, you know, maybe 10 miles away from the actual city, and that wasn't easy to get provisions. As St. Luke, who accompanied Paul on this voyage, says, the haven was not commodious to winter in. In other words, it wasn't a good place to stay for the winter. For this reason, and the fact that the ship was running late, the ship's captain, with the centurion concurring, were reluctant to stay for the winter there. So they decided to sail on, in spite of Paul's warnings not to. You see, this is probably, you're getting into probably October, you know, maybe late September into October. And as you moved into November, you're getting into the winter months. And that, the weather was really, really bad on the Mediterranean. For the most part, the ships just simply didn't ply the Mediterranean during that bad weather because, you know, there was always a good probability that you'd run into a bad storm.
This voyage, as you're giving his warning, turned out to be disastrous.
Yes, it did. They were hoping that they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete looking northeast and southeast, and winter there. And this must have been close, as I said, to November of 61, because the prevailing high northwest winds during the month make the Mediterranean almost impossible to navigate by sailing vessels.
This voyage then turned out to be disastrous?
Yes, it did. At first, a gentle south wind blew the ship along the coast smoothly. But soon a northeaster wind blew in from the land and started to toss the ship about violently. In fact, so much so that after a day of this, they began to toss some of the cargo overboard to save the ship. Eventually, they even threw overboard the ship's rigging or tackle used to load and unload cargo. As the storm continued for several days and the ship drifted aimlessly, driven by the wind, they gave up hope of ever being saved. Paul told them that they should have listened to him, but told the men to take heart, because that night he had been told by an angel of the Lord, whom he worshipped, that the ship would be wrecked, but all of them would survive. As the ship approached the land for fear that the ship would crash into the rocks, some of the sailors lowered a boat to escape. However, Paul warned the centurion, who was kind of in charge along with the captain of the ship, that they would all perish if these men were allowed to abandon ship. So the centurion ordered the soldiers to cut the lines attached to the boat, to the lifeboat, to let it go. This precarious situation had gone on for 2 weeks, when Paul told the men to eat some of the wheat stored on board the ship, that they would need the strength to survive. St. Luke tells us that there were 276 men aboard the ship. After eating their fill, they threw the wheat overboard to lighten the ship. As the Lalita Day approached, they noticed that they were approaching a bay with a beach. So the soldiers cut off the anchors, loosened the ropes that tied the ship's rudders, and hoisted the foresail to the wind and made for the beach. Unfortunately, the ship ran into a shoal or a sandbar, and the surf began breaking up the ship. The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners, but were stopped by the centurion. He ordered those who could swim to head for the shore first, and the rest to grab hold of the planks or pieces of the ship with which to make their way to the shore, that is, those who couldn't swim. As Paul had predicted, they all made it safely to land. As it turned out, this was the island of Malta, and this story is told in Acts 27.
Okay, we're down to 3 minutes. You want to say a word about Malta?
Well, Malta is an island south of Italy in the Mediterranean Sea. And as we discussed, Paul was shipwrecked on his journey to Rome. The inhabitants were very friendly to the stranger, and after he was bitten by a venomous snake and didn't die, they thought he was a god. He preached the gospel for 3 months afterwards, and during this time cured of a fever and dysentery the father of the governor of the island, a man named Publius. He also cured many others of their diseases as well. When the visitors left the island, they were given many gifts by the inhabitants as a token of their gratitude. This story is told in Acts 28.
Okay, Paul's continuing his journey to Sicily and Italy and finally to Rome. Can you tell us what went on in Sicily?
After wintering about 3 months in Malta, the centurion and soldiers took Paul and his companions on board a ship from Alexandria that had also wintered on the island. In other words, they changed ships. They stopped off at Syracuse, which is on the east side of Sicily, for 3 days, then on to Rhegium, which is in southern Italy. In other words, they went from the island of Sicily over to the mainland of Italy. For a day, they stayed there at Puteoli, which is about 100 miles southeast of Rome, where they spent time with fellow Christians for a week. At last to Rome, where many Christians came to meet them. The Romans gave Paul a lot of liberty at Rome, the Roman soldiers did. Basically, he was put under house arrest with only one soldier guarding him and with companions allowed to come and go at will.
We're down to 1 minute, so I think we're going to have to continue later on our next round, Ron. So to our listening audience, we say may God bless you all, always, and in all ways.